immediately go wherever there is good protection for the cows and brahmanas, and wherever the Vedas are studied in terms of Vanashram principles. Set fire to those places and cut from the roots the trees there, which are the source of life. So before I begin, I just want to seek the blessings of all the Vaishnavas assembled. Anyone know who's speaking in this verse? Because whoever's speaking is giving an order. Yeah, Hiranyakashipu, yeah. So he's given this instruction to search out brahmanas, wherever the Vedas are being studied, set fire to those places, cut from the roots, the trees there. So it's quite interesting, because later what you see is Prahlad Maharaj, he's also searching out sadhus and brahmanas, but he's doing it to receive their association, whereas Hiranyakashipu, he's trying to attain their association to actually kill them. So we see a contrast in consciousness here, and very clearly we see the divine nature and the demonic nature. In the purport, Prabhupada makes many points, but he focuses on two subjects, and I was hoping in the course of today's class I'd perhaps elaborate on those points. So the first point that Prabhupada mentions is the Vanashram system, and Prabhupada describes it as when human civilization is following Vedic civilization or Vanashram, then it's described as perfect human civilization. And Prabhupada would often quote his Guru Maharaj. He would say, religion without philosophy is sentiment, and philosophy without religion is mental speculation. So we have a great philosophy, but often we have difficulties applying it in our life. And this is where the culture comes in, that the culture is a manifestation of an application of the philosophy. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya, he mentions there's three principles spoken about in the Vedas. It can be summarized into these three: Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prajna. And actually these principles can be applied in any endeavor or effort. Sambandha means knowledge, or relationship. So the idea is that we understand that we're a spiritual being, there's Krishna, and our goal in life is to connect with Krishna. But then Abhideya is described as the process or devotional service. It's the application of that knowledge. And this is kind of where the Vanashram or the Vedic civilization and culture comes in. And if we fail to apply the Vedic principles, then we will not attain Prajna, which is love of God, or the goal of whatever endeavor you're undertaking. And in this regard, the result of our practice of devotional service is we attain Krishna Prem. So this culture is important to understand, and not just understand, but to apply in our lives. And Prabhupada would often speak about India and how we can learn a lot of things from India, in particular regards to culture. He would often encourage some of his disciples to stay in India and learn from cultured families. Like he told Subhag Swami, because Subhag Swami, he comes from an aristocratic Bengali family. So he told him not to forget what his parents taught him, but whatever he does, he should just add Krishna to his life. And, you know, even though we see that a lot of the original Vedic culture has been lost in India, still, there's a lot we can learn. Like, I think Prabhupada gave the example of an elephant. You know, whether an elephant is alive or dead, it still carries some value. So like this, we see that culture is important. Also, if we observe the culture that's practiced in the spiritual world, it's Vedic culture. When you read pastimes between Krishna and his devotees, you'll see that the interactions are based on Vedic culture. We see that, Krishna, he's a cowherd boy, he's a Vaishya, I mean, he's a supreme personality of Godhead, no doubt. But we see when they interact accordingly to their varna. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he also described that this varnashram. He gave an analogy. He said it's like a school. The goal of school is not to remain in school, but the goal is to graduate. And so that graduation is seen as, from our perspectives, as attaining self-realization or realizing Krishna in completeness. So in the same way, the varnashram system is there to achieve that. Ultimately, the varnashram system, what it does, it allows us, regardless of what our conditionings are, to come closer to Krishna. And as we practice varnashram alongside devotional service, we become more and more purified, and eventually we come to the transcendental platform, where varnashram isn't necessary, but a liberated soul, he may still practice the external externals of the varnashram system to set an example. Like we see Lord Chaitanya, when he appeared on this planet, and when he took sannyas, he was very strict in his regards to following the principles that a sannyasi is meant to follow, because he saw that if he didn't set an example, others would also perhaps deviate. And ultimately, when you're talking about varnashram, you're talking about certain rules and regulations. Now, it's not that the rules and regulations are there just for the sake of being there. In the Padma Purana, it explains the purpose of these rules and regulations. Smata vyasa tatam vishnu. Vishmata vya najitutit. Sarva vidhi nishadashur etaryor evakin karaha. That the rules and regulations of the Vedic writings have one purpose. You could say two. To always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. So according to what varna you're in, every aspect of your life would be controlled, like your environment, the food that you took, the codes of conduct, how you would deal. But the whole purpose of it was to address or to meet this principle. Bhaktivedanta Swami, he was giving a nice class on this, and he explained that there's different paths or platforms of devotional service. So he describes the first platform is Bhagavat platform. Now, this is commonly understood as Shavanam Kirtanam, is chanting and hearing. But he described that we practice a Bhagavat platform, but we're conditioned. But strictly speaking, the Bhagavat platform is for liberated souls. I'll explain a little more what I mean by that. It's meant for those on the Brahma-Buddha platform. Those on the Brahma-Buddha platform, they have no attraction for the material world. But at the same time, they may not have attraction for the spiritual world. So the focus for them is not prevention of forgetting or being attracted to the material world. But the focus for them is to remember Krishna. So this is the Bhagavad platform, Shravanam Kirtanam. And you have the likes of Haridas Thakur, you have the likes of the four Kumaras that are qualified to be on this platform. And typically someone who's on the Bhagavad platform, he's capable of chanting all day long. And many of us can quite easily understand that we're not ready for this. Just if we observe ourselves in japa, we start falling asleep in japa, or we lose attention in japa, we have to stand up and circumambulate Tulsi Devi. So Prabhupada wouldn't encourage this for the general masses. And someone on this platform, he doesn't, whether he gets prasad, whether he doesn't, it's not an issue for him. He may take rest if he remembers that he's tired. That's someone who's situated on that platform. And this is for rare souls. And he said the next platform is the Pancharatrik platform. Now, this is where our life revolves around a deity. Like we have one book called Pancharatrika Pradipa, which describes the nature of someone on that platform or the service that one performs on that platform. So we know that Harinam is the essential practice in the age of Kali. But alongside that, Prabhupada encouraged us to perform archana, deity worship. And one reason given is that it reduces our material contamination. It forces us to come to the mode of goodness. and it also increases our devotional tendencies. So in this way, properly encourage general practitioners to perform chanting and hearing alongside deity worship. They were, it's like two roads running parallel to each other. And it's not one or the other. It's not that we should just focus on deity worship and neglect chanting and hearing. Prabhupada often said that also, that if you do not regularly chant and hear, then the worshipping of the deity will become a burden. Just the other day, we were watching, following Srila Prabhupada at Soho Street Temple, and Jaya Advaita Swami was on a morning walk, and he said to Prabhupada that since you've come to this temple, the deities have become even more beautiful. And so Prabhupada replied saying that this is my anxiety. And so Jaya Advaita Swami couldn't quite understand what he meant by that. And so they went on the morning walk, and then Prabhupada repeated the same statement. He said, this is my anxiety. And then he explained. He said, this is my anxiety because when I leave, you will not appreciate the deities. So this chanting and hearing is also essential in our appreciation for the deities. So if we are satisfied chanting and hearing and engaging in direct service around the deity, then that's all that's needed. But if we need more than that, Bhaktivedanta Swami was explaining, is that that's when the Vedic has to come in. That's where the Varnashram. The Varnashram is there because Pancharatrika is Brahminical culture, essentially. But if we want to, you know, deal with, we have family life, social scene, management, then this is where the Varnashram system is. And, you know, Prabhupada points out the different duties that a Kshatriya has, the different duties that a Vaishya has, the different duties that a Shudra has. And so the idea is that whatever attachments we have, whatever nature we have, we can. There's a way to connect it with Krishna. And that's the broadness of the Varnashram system. The idea is that not everyone fits into the same box. You know, everyone will have their own inclinations, have their own habits. And the idea is that there's a structure, and this structure is created in such a way that regardless of what nature you have, everyone can is directed to the same goal, which is ultimately loving and pleasing Krishna. Now, there's also different types of Varnashram. For example, there's ordinary Varnashram. There's Asura Varnashram, and there's Daivi Varnashram. And I'll explain a little bit about these and the differences between them. Ordinary Varnashram means you have clear divisions between each of the Varnas. So, and each Varna has a different level of consciousness. And as you go from Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmana, the consciousness becomes more spiritual, elevated. So the Shudra has the lowest level of consciousness. And this is described in the Upanishads as anamoya. And so basically, that someone on that level, his only concern is how can I derive pleasure in regards to my senses. It's like a child, you know. If you see sometimes how some children interact and deal, their consciousness is, what enjoyment can I derive from this situation? For someone on the Vaishya platform, his consciousness is on the level of pranamoya, which is extended sense gratification. So, you know, his concern is his family, nation. But still, his only interest in that is because he's receiving some sense gratification from it. Like morality, justice, you know, like, oh, you know, there's a certain area of land, draw a line in the middle, I take this part, you take that part. But the idea is that there's fear that someone else will encroach on their particular assets or property. So still there's the principle of sense gratification. And then the next level is you have Kshatriyas, and their consciousness is manamoya, or sometimes Prabhupada would say, Jnanamoya. And their concern is with dharma. They want to deal with the actual nature of things. And their focus is on organization of morality, organization of social dealings. And then you have the Brahmanas, and their consciousness is on the level of Vijnanamoya, which means they understand they're not the body and they have deep knowledge of Shastra. And with these, there's clear divisions. And there's a lot of restrictions. One devotee was given an example of how he has a brother or friend, I can't remember which one, who's very business-minded. And to make money, he decided to get involved in schools, get involved in creating schools. And this kind of became a problem, because when you have schools that are run by businessmen, when they look at education, they're thinking, how can I make money from this situation? That's why traditionally, Vaishyas would not be involved in education. And because there was a shortage of, basically there were more students than schools, this person was actually holding parents to ransom, basically. He could request whatever finances he wanted to allow a particular child or a particular parent to be enrolled in a school. And he would, you know, in addition, he would charge so many different fees to make money. Like even LSC, London School of Economics in London, they say 70% of the students there are actually international students. And there's a big, huge difference between the fees that an international student has to pay and a local student has to pay. So, I mean, I've not investigated LSC, and I doubt I am going to, but I'm sure there's some wealthy person behind the institution. Or, like, sometimes there's an injunction in the Vedas that says that a Shudra is forbidden to study the Vedas. Now, if you look in the academic world, you see that there's academics that know Sanskrit far better than us, many in this room. They know, you know, some of the Goswami's teachings far better than us. Some people I know are doing PhDs on Rupa Goswami's writings, Jiva Goswami's writings. But they don't have any Brahminical qualities. In fact, they're discussing these things in a bar while, you know, taking a pint of alcohol. You know, that's the culture. And the problem is, if they become authorities on Vedic writings, it becomes, it can lead to a lot of chaos and madness. We also have the example in Mahabharata how Ekalavya wanted to be a disciple of Dronacharya. Now, he wasn't qualified, he was very qualified actually in regards to skills. But because his nature was of a low nature, there was a fear that even if Dronacharya trained him, then he would misuse his abilities and powers. So in ordinary Vrindavan, there was very strict divisions. Then you have Asura Vrindavan. Sometimes we have people that follow the rules and regulations of the Vedas, but don't understand the purpose of the rules and regulations of the Vedas. Like you have many smarter Brahmanas in India, very strict, adhere to the principles of the Vedas very strictly, and look down upon anyone that doesn't follow them. But at the same time, simultaneously, they don't have any faith that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Like you have the example of in the Krishna book of how when the cowherd boys approach the brahmanas to serve Krishna, they refuse. Also, you see, also it's quite interesting if you observe the lives of the great demons that we hear about, like Hiranyakashipu, Ravana. It's not that they were kind of like, you know, riding around in a BMW or Harley Davidson, and, you know, wearing like tight jeans and a cap. They were wearing dhotis. Regularly they would perform certain rituals that are outlined in the Vedas. To some degree they were following the rules and regulations of the Vedas, but completely neglecting the sole purpose behind them. So this is kind of like Asura Vrindavan. We also see that it's quite interesting because that culture, there's a common culture, that even the Asuras can interact with the divine personalities. Like you see Duryodhan and Arjun and the Pandavas, because they both followed the system of a national Vedic civilization, they could interact, although their particular purposes for following them were perhaps a little different. And then you have Daivi Vrindavan, and this is particularly what Prabhupada encouraged, and this is slightly different. In the same class, Bhaktivedanta Swami, he was explaining that in one purport, Prabhupada explains that there's three types of Brahmins. One is Dvija. One is someone who receives the sacred thread. He's twice born. And this is the lowest level in regards to one who's a Brahmana. Then the second level is Vipra. Vipra means that he's already been second initiated. He's received the thread. But now he's undergone a certain duration of time of study. Usually it's like 12 years. And he becomes an expert in a particular field of the Vedas. Perhaps Sanskrit, grammar, Nyaya, like this. But then he said the topmost Brahmana is a Vaishnava. And many times if you read Prabhupada's books, you'll hear him say this again and again and again. So he said this is the topmost Brahmana. And he said he was making this point that in the Daivi Vanashram, this Brahminical culture is encouraged through all Varnas. There's a Brahminical basis for everyone. This Pancharatric path is encouraged for everyone. You would see when Prabhupada said that one should do deity worship, he didn't differentiate. He encouraged everyone and anyone to perform deity worship. And in this type of system, the main thing isn't the Varna, the main thing is consciousness. Hence, someone who's perhaps engaged in Shudra-type work can be theoretically more advanced than someone who's engaged in Brahminical work. And in one sense, also, these, like for example, if a devotee has to clean the floor, then in one sense, it's not that he's doing Shudra work, because his purpose is pleasing Krishna. So he's a Vaishnava. And so in that sense, he's the topmost Brahmana. And because of this, also the activities can be interchangeable. One example was given how, in New Vrindavan, there was one devotee who would, for 12 hours a day, he would plow the fields. But every day, without fail, he would get up before Mangalati, chant all his rounds, attend Mangalati, and actually, I think during Mangalati, at some point in the morning, he would dress Radharani every single day. And it was said that also he would incessantly read Chaitanya Charitamrita. And whenever he would get an opportunity to speak, he would just recite Chaitanya Lila. So we see various activities. His pujari, his preaching, his plowing the fields. And so this is the difference between ordinary Varnashram and Daivi Varnashram. For example, strictly speaking, if you're a Kshatriya, there are certain injunctions or Shishivada Gokulananda ki jai, Shishigornitai ki jai, Shishitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai. There are certain concessions. Like a Kshatriya, he's allowed to have more than one wife. He's allowed to take certain intoxicants, he's allowed to hunt, he's allowed to kill animals. But we never see Prabhupada ever talk about them or introduce them. And in fact, there's one incident where one devotee actually wanted to have a second wife. And, so don't get any ideas, guys. And Prabhupada chastised him very seriously. And in the end, he said, if you want to do it, then you can do it, but you do it outside of ISKCON. Like this, we see that Prabhupada's emphasis was on Daivi Varnashram. So anyway, there's just a few points I wanted to share on that Varnashram topic. Now, the second point that Prabhupada makes in the purport is he speaks about trees and how now the days people are cutting down trees and producing, he says, nonsensical literatures. But he says that if devotees, they take the same trees and produce transcendental literatures to glorify Krishna, to enlighten people, then this is considered yajna. Now, this is quite interesting and important, I think. I remember once I was doing book distribution, and someone refused, a few times actually, people refused to take books because they say, I'm not sure whether I'm going to read them or not. And, you know, I don't want to waste paper. You know, someone's trees are being cut down. You should give these books to someone who will actually use them. Now, we see that we produce many, many books. But because it's yajna, and it pleases the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it's not considered a waste. And in fact, it said that when one performs sacrifice or yajna, by pleasing the Lord, automatically the demigods are pleased. And naturally, more trees are going to be present on this planet as a result. So this is a proper way, actually, of using the resources of this material world. And this book distribution actually is quite essential and important, because we see, like in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says, Krishna boli se jiva anadi bahimuk, daiva maya tare deha samsara duk. It's explained that because entities have forgotten Krishna, daiva maya tare deha samsara duk, people are suffering in this material world. Also, we learn from Nectar of Devotion that the root of all suffering is avidya, ignorance. So this knowledge counters that ignorance. In one purport, Prabhupada explains that actually there's a class of people that are propagating God, atheism. And so he encourages us to counteract that propaganda. We should also create our own propaganda through book distribution or transcendental literature distribution. And specifically, this inspiration of Prabhupada's to push book distribution came from his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. It's considered that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's the pioneer. But Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is described as a person who actually implemented a lot of the ideas that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had. In fact, he would often have huge publication houses. And he would often say that, the deity worship and the publication houses, they go hand in hand together, like I mentioned the Bhagavat Mark and the Pancharatrik path. He described the Pancharatrik path as the deity worship and the Bhagavat path as the publication of transcendental literature. In fact, he says that the publication houses are none different to the Lord's abode. He would say that the bricks that the houses are made from are Chintamani. And even Prabhupada admitted there were many incidences where he also exemplified this point. Like once Prabhupada walked into a printing house and there was a printer there, and Prabhupada paid his obeisances to the printer. And so everyone's a little bemused why Prabhupada had done this. The printers were there, executives were there, and the disciples were there. So they asked him. And Prabhupada said that this is an incarnation of Srila Vyasadeva. That was his consciousness and perspective. And we see our acharyas are quite revolutionary when it comes to our traditional renunciates, or the conception of traditional renunciation. Traditionally, one who was a sadhu, sannyasi, he would be engaged in bhajan in some remote place, in some forest or some cave. But we see that our acharyas and our teachers, they often situate themselves in the center of activity, or the center of cities. One time, Gorkishodas Babaji, who's known as a Bhajananandi, he told Bhaktivinoda Thakur that he should not stay in Calcutta, and he should return to Mayapur. He actually used to call Calcutta, he called it Kalikutta, which basically means the abode of Kali. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he sent a message back to Gorkishodas Babaji saying that where I stay is not a place of Kali. And so like this transcendental lila will go on. And I want to read one quote just by Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, just one or two quotes in this book, which is produced by Bhaktivikas Swami on the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. He says that an acharya who comes for the service of the Lord cannot be expected to conform to a stereotype. For he must find the ways and means by which Krishna consciousness may be spread. And particularly this principle of yukta vairagya is quite important in this regard. We have the verse, anasatasya visayan yitarham upayanjataha nimbande krishna sambande yuktam vairagyam uchate. So the idea is that if one takes, because this world belongs to Krishna, and if we use these things in this world for Krishna's pleasure, then it's actually considered renunciation. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj also in the same section, he gives an example to describe how this Yukta Vairagya works. He says it's like the nature of a serpent or a snake. A snake will never try and create its own or construct its own place of residence. What it will do, it will let some other animal entity create a particular place of residence, and it will just take it over. So similarly, in the same way, he said, materialists are endeavoring in so many ways to produce different applications. Like he gives the example of various lights, transport mechanisms. So he says that devotees shouldn't endeavor to create them, but if we can use them in Krishna's service, the principle of Yukta Vairagya, then great, use them. And Rupa Goswami says the other side of Yukta Vairagya is false renunciation, or Falgu Vairagya. And if something can be used in Krishna's service and is not used in the name of renunciation, then this is considered Falgu Vairagya, like the Mayavadis or the impersonalists. They say Brahma Satyam Jagat Mitya. I mean, really speaking, they don't even have faith that Krishna is God. So there's no idea of connecting anything to Krishna. But Shiv Ramaswami explains this principle nicely in Sudha Bhaktin Chintamani. He explains that there's a branch, a river that branches out from the Ganga, and it's called Falgu. And this river has an interesting nature. It appears dry, so if you look at it, it looks like it's just covered by sand. But if you go closer, you see that there's a thin layer of sand upon a flowing river. And so he says, in the same way that this type of renunciation, although it may look like renunciation, underneath, if you dig deep, you'll see that this individual has many, many material desires. It's like the example of monkey renunciation, right? You look at a monkey, it looks very renounced, right? A monkey has no clothes, it lives in a forest, eats nuts, etc. But the monkey is always thinking of sense gratification. In the same section, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, it's mentioned how, see, he saw that Westerners, the West, were becoming the leaders of the world. And India in particular was becoming influenced by this. And so he saw that to spread Krishna consciousness, that he had to win the respect and attention of these persons. Traditionally, like if you were poorly dressed and you lived in poverty, this was appreciated and respected by men. But because things were changing now, and many people in the name of renunciation were posing as beggars and making a living, this wasn't appreciated so much. So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he encouraged his disciples, and he showed by his personal example that we should dress nicely. And I'll read this, that kind of gives more of an insight. He says, many make a drama of chanting three lakh names, yet merely a show of chanting without disturbing others, will not benefit anyone, except perhaps oneself. Therefore we are preaching, by approaching the people of the world, dressed even somewhat better than they, showing knowledge even somewhat greater than theirs, being even somewhat more stylish than they, without which they would think us worthless and not listen to our Harikatha. It's quite interesting. He also says, I have to go to various places for propagating Harikatha, so I must present myself as a learned and decent gentleman. Otherwise, non-devotees will not give me their time. We even see sometimes, when you hear some of the pastimes of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, you hear about how he would going to Radhakund with a Rolls Royce. We see that he's an acharya, he's setting an example, he's teaching us how we have to perhaps adapt a little for preaching purposes. There's even an incident which I wasn't sure whether I should mention, but I think I will because it's there. But there was one time the governor of Bengal, he came to see come to the Gaudiya Math, and it's described via the Calcutta Hotel that Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he arranged for meat to be served to this individual, which could be considered quite controversial. And in fact, he was even thinking that for the preachers that go to foreign places, that this could also be allowance. And Sridhar Swami, one of the senior disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he said that this would invite a lot of criticism. And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said that many thousands of lifetimes ago, I made a vow to Lord Chaitanya that I'm ready to do anything and everything to serve him. It's also described another time that a German scholar came to the Gaudiya Mutt and he wanted to smoke, so the Gaudiya Mutt supplied cigarettes. But this has to be understood in context as well. They're acharyas. We're not acharyas. We have to remember that. So what we have to do has to be done with care and caution. The other point is that being acharyas, they're nitya siddhas. So they're able to take things from this world, engage them in Krishna's service. But we may deal with the objects of the senses, wealth, etc. But we may, instead of engage them in Krishna's service, we may engage them in our own service. Like I think it was Shripuri quoted in one class, that Lord Chaitanya, I'm explaining some history behind this. There was two sannyasis who were fighting over money, management. And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj stopped them. And he said that Lord Chaitanya, he took kings and he made them into beggars. But I took beggars and I made them into kings. So this is the problem. Because we have, we've had connection, conditioning with objects of the senses for lifetimes. Because of that, we have to be careful and cautious when we deal with these things. We even hear about the Bagh Bazaar, the Gaudiya temple, and how, you know, the idea was that temple would be like a center of the Gaudiya activities and it would be send out a message to the world. But in the end, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj actually regretted the fact that this temple had been established because it was causing so much fighting. In fact, he said that better we sell the marble and print books. And Prabhupada also followed in the footsteps of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. Like once there was a press conference and a reporter said, because Prabhupada was staying in the Hilton Hotel in Hong Kong, and the reporter said, you know, you're a monk, you're supposed to renounce it. How come you're staying in the Hilton Hotel? What kind of renouncer are you? And then Prabhupada began to explain what renunciation means. Renunciation means to take whatever there is in this world and please engage it and connect it to the Lord. But the reporter wasn't satisfied. So then Prabhupada said, I can live under a tree. And then the reporter was a little interested. But he said, if I live under a tree and I called the press conference, would you come? And the reporter said, no. And then Prabhupada said, this is why I'm staying at the Hilton Hotel. Another time, a reporter, he said that, you know, you're a monk and traditionally sannyasis, you know, they walk on foot when they walk from one place to another. You're flying on jets. What is this? What kind of renouncer are you? And Prabhupada gave an example. Imagine you have a criminal and the police are chasing this criminal and they're chasing him in a vehicle and there's a speed limit. You know, you can't go faster than 80 kilometers per hour. And the police, they break the speed limit. Now, would people criticize police for doing this? No, they'll glorify the police. So he said in the same way, people of this planet are going to hell faster than the speed of a jet. So in order to save them, I need to fly on a jet. So like this, Prabhupada would explain and show how he is following the principle of Yukta Vairagya. And also for preaching, Prabhupada would be very broad and understanding. Like, again, we were watching following Srila Prabhupada video. And in that video, Prabhupada was in Fiji. And people like Madhu Dwisa and Shutaketi Prabhu were relating memories and pastimes. And one of the key devotees in Fiji is someone called Vasudev Prabhu, and he was instrumental in establishing the temple there. And at that time, his family had a big business, and they had like an array of shops. And one of the shops that they had was a butcher's shop. And so when devotees found out that they had a butcher's shop, they were shocked. And they were ready, you know, as devotees are, to correct them and chastise them. But before they did this, they wrote a letter to Prabhupada and asked for Prabhupada's opinion on this. And Prabhupada said, don't disturb them. He said, let them be. He said, everything will come in time. That was in his instruction. And in the same video, another Indian, because it's Fiji, another Indian, he read he was chanting Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna. Basically, it was the wrong way around. And again, devotees wrote a letter to Prabhupada and said, what should we say? What should we instruct to this person? And Prabhupada replied, he said, well, he's chanting. He's chanting the names of God. So let him be. Tamil Krishna Maharaj, he was also relating an interesting pastime. There was a Harinam in India. And you know, Harinams were big in the West. But during this particular Harinam, the people started throwing money at the devotees. And so they related this pastime to Prabhupada. And obviously the image that was being given off is that they're beggars. And so Prabhupada said, stop Harinam. And it's just interesting, if you look at the preaching that was going on in the West and you compare it to India, it's different. Like obviously you saw book distribution, Harinam going on in the West, and it was appreciated and it made devotees. But in India you see Prabhupada's focus was more bandal programs, life membership. So we see that the acharyas adapt according to particular situations. In that same video, there was one Indian family that invited Prabhupada and disciples for prasad. And that day happened to be Ekadashi. They weren't aware. So they began to serve grains to the disciples and Prabhupada. And disciples whispered to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, this is grains. Prabhupada said, don't worry, take prasad. And it's quite interesting because the devotees really feasted at that program. And it said that they slept at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And the next day they went to the morning program. And you know, they were keen on taking some rest. And I think particularly Shuddha Kirtipur and Paramahamsa Swami were speaking and saying this. And 9 o'clock hit, Prabhupada finished his breakfast, and Prabhupada went for a nap. And so they thought, this is the time, let's go and take rest. And they thought Prabhupada would sleep for hours. But they went and they slept, and then they heard the bell ring 15 minutes later. Prabhupada got up. And bell meant, you know, you have to be there. And so Shuddha Kirtipur quickly ran into the room. And Prabhupada said, have you been sleeping? And then he began to chastise him. Why are you sleeping? Sleeping, he said, means dead man. Means dead. You're dead. And like this. And Shuddha Kirtipur, because he knew the nature of Prabhupada, that if you chastise, you don't reply. You just ask, say you're sorry. And so he did that. And then Prabhupada called Paramahamsa Swami. And he said the same thing. Are you sleeping? You're a sannyasi. Why are you sleeping? And then Paramahamsa Swami, he began to, you know, argue, oh, Prabhupada, we only slept 3 hours. And Prabhupada says, so what? I sleep less than you. And I'm a sannyasi. And so like we see this, you know, at one level, Prabhupada's very broad-minded and trying to connect and encourage everyone and anyone to come closer to Krishna. But at the same time, we see that for others, he's very strict. So the point is, we see from this that it's not black and white. We have to assess in a particular situation what's appropriate and what's not. But at the same time, we're not acharyas, so whatever decisions we make and however we go forward should be done in consultation with senior devotees. Anyway, that's just a few points that I wanted to share that I've come in touch with recently. Thank you for listening. We have time for comments. Maybe there's a few corrections, because I was a little hesitant to speak on these topics, because they're a little controversial as well, but I think it's important to hear them as well. But anyone want to make any corrections or comments? Or